Welcome to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio. I'm Dr. Marcia Mount Shute.
And I'm Coach John Shute.
John's coached at the highest levels of the game of football for 26 years.
And Marcia is an author, theologian, and minister.
John and I met in a religion class in Oxford, England.
Actually, we were in a pub.
Okay, that's a minor detail. My point is you've always thought of coaching as teaching. You like to think deeply about things.
And you love sports. Heck, you're the one in your college's athletic hall of fame.
We're Team Shute, and we're glad you've joined us to go deep into some of the most pressing issues of our time.
On Going Deep, we go beyond sound bites and highlight reels. This episode of Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, the collegiate sports arms race.
People are up in arms about the arms race, and they have been for decades.
It's a race to win the battle on one of the most important fronts there is in collegiate revenue sports, the recruiting battle.
Academicians and ethicists alike have looked at the excess of the collegiate arms race as an emblem of what's wrong in college sports.
And the reasons will sound familiar. I.e. athletes are being given special treatment. Money's being spent on things that don't match up with the priorities of academic communities. The commercialization of sports and special privileges, and et cetera, et cetera.
But on this show, we really try not to stop where things are familiar. We go deeper, and so today we want to explore what the arms race really has to tell us about things like equity, justice, and the priorities of higher education in America these days. And on Going Deep, remember, a win for us is if we wonder, investigate, and notice. And so today, that's what our business is.
And we're going to have some help from players, a sports economist, and from a college professor who studies sports culture as we dig deep. Let's start with one of the most prominent football programs in the country at the University of Texas.
So I hear they've got some new lockers at the University of Texas.
Do they ever? The Texas Longhorns football team just installed over 100 lockers. Each locker has a 43-inch flat-screen TV and glow-in-the-dark doors. The cost of each locker was $10,500. Interestingly, the president at UT was recently quoted as saying he cannot comprehend paying student-athletes. I, for one, can't comprehend having a locker that costs $10,500 to make.
I'm sure you can't, but guess what? I can top that. Let's take a look at what they're doing at Clemson University. Dabo Land is the newest weapon in their arms race arsenal. Dabo Land includes a putt-putt golf course, a slide from one level of the building to the lower level, a full-service barbershop, a player nap room that frankly looks like some weird thing for oversized babies, a covered outdoor basketball court, an outdoor recreation area with sand volleyball and a fire pit, and also a space for indoor fun like laser tag, a golf simulator, and video games. Reportedly, this costs about $55 million.
You know, it's interesting because excess and moral indignation about the arms race, well, it's not new. In 1989, the John S. and the James L. Knight Commission was formed in response to some sports scandals that occurred in the 80s. On their website, the Knight Commission states that a goal is ensuring that intercollegiate athletic programs operate within the educational mission of their colleges and universities. Does laser tag and putt-putt golf course, is that within the educational commitment?
Well, it's interesting because when I've studied the Knight Commission, one of the things that really stuck out to me is that they use the word alien to describe what's happening in athletic departments. They want to rein in the, quote, alien forces of athletic departments and entitled athletes. And for decades, they have cited the escalating arms race as one of the alarming signs that collegiate sports are out of control, that they had too much power on the campuses. And so the Knight Commission suggested, and it was enacted, that the presidents of the university take control of the NCAA, that they drive the ship, that they create the policies so that proper balance can be maintained between academics and athletics. Well, since 1989, or actually probably in the early 90s, that has been the way that rules have been made. The presidents have been in charge. And by the commission's own admission in two different follow-up reports, the arms race has gotten worse with the presidents at the helm. And players then, part of this narrative that has really taken hold and become very tenacious is that players get stereotyped as entitled, coddled, and treated like a special class of people on campuses. And it makes me wonder, like, is all this stuff really what players want? Because when I talked to the Knight Commission when I was writing Touchdowns for Jesus, I realized they don't have player representation. They had two players on the board who had not played for a long time, and actually one of them wasn't even active on the board anymore. So is this what players really want, all these bells and whistles?
Well, to find out, I asked a bunch of players. I just went through my phone kind of randomly, and I chose 50 players that were in my phone. Everyone from Heisman Trophy winners and Heisman Trophy finalists and players that have played a good while in the NFL to walk-ons who never played a down of college football. Every race, every economic, socio background. I thought we had a nice cross-section of players that I texted, and here's what I asked. I asked every one of these players, would you rather have over 100 flat-screen TVs in your locker room or have $10,500 to use at your discretion for expenses at college, to send home, travel costs for family to and from games? So A was 100 flat screen TVs, or B was the $10,500 that the University of Texas used to create your individual lock. The response? Well, here's what some of the players say. No doubt, it'd be option B, coach. Option B, give me the money all day. Definitely B option, I'll take the cash. B, not even a question. Option B, easily. Definitely B, I'll take the money every day of the week. Yeah, I'm going to need all that $10,500, coach. B, final answer, B, I need the $10,500, coach. Definitely the money, money. B, I'd take the money hands down. Money, it's a no-brainer. I would certainly choose option B. I would rather use the money for family travel and or clothes, perhaps even buy a used car. These are just some of the responses that I got on the informal poll of the text that we sent out.
Right. So again, this just seems like a quintessential example that we see over and over again, not just in big time sports, but in our culture at large, that the people who are most affected by the decision have the least to say about how the decision is made or what decision is made.
Well, we've got some of those guys that have been affected by the decision on the phone here. Let's talk to them.
Coach Shoup, how's it going?
Bryn Renner. You're on the phone with Shoup and Marsha.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, my gosh. You made my day.
I wish I could hop through this phone.
Hey, my man, would you introduce yourself to our audience?
How's everybody doing? My name is Bryn Renner. I played quarterback for my favorite coach and my favorite coach's wife of all time at the University of North Carolina, the great John Shoup and Marsha Shoup.
Hey, you're the best, man. Now, let me ask you this, Bryn. Would you rather, A, have over 100 flat-screen TVs in your locker room, or B, have the $10,500 that's used to make that locker to use at your discretion for expenses at college, to send home to family, for travel costs to family to and from games?
You know, having a flat-screen TV is really irrelevant because, one, it takes away from the time you have in a locker room with your teammates. You can't build a culture if everyone's looking at a TV screen or on a cell phone. Those conversations after practice, after you didn't perform very well, and if you go into a shell and watch a TV screen above your locker, that doesn't really benefit the team. So I would definitely go with, you know, using the money in a certain way that helps benefit the whole team.
That's a pretty good point there, Bryn.
I'm so proud of you, Bryn. That's actually a pretty good point.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We're getting enamored by the material things as a society when we're losing the fact that it's about the people who are there.
That's
so insightful, Bryn. Thank you.
Hello?
Mr. Torwoodso.
What's going on?
Hey, Mr. Torwoodso, would you introduce yourself to our audience, my man?
Absolutely. So my name is Charles Torwoodso. I played wide receiver and tight end at Purdue University. I had the pleasure of playing there and being coached by Coach Shoup.
A or B?
Well, that's, in my opinion, that's really a no-brainer, right? So as a college athlete, you know, a lot of times you don't have that disposable income. So definitely I'd go with the second option without question. I would take $10,000 directly in my pocket versus going to a program that has a slide or a barber, you know, a barber shop in the locker room, just because, again, you know, that may be cool and it's trendy now, right? But, you know, that money and that 10 grand can go a lot farther as far as, you know, quality of life and being able to, you know, go about your business daily on campus. So, you know, that $10,000 would be great. Obviously, more would be better. And would even take it a little bit further, right?
Well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this, Charles. Do you think that someday in the future, instead of building a slide, building a putt-putt golf course, building a paintball arena, building a barber shop, they're going to use the recruit employ of, we're going to take all that money and give it to you instead? Is that on the horizon?
I can't speak to whether that is or is not, but for the sake of all student athletes, I genuinely hope that is on the horizon.
Hey, Mike, it's this Shoop. How's it going?
It's going, man. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm great. I accidentally just called your home number and spoke with your dad.
Oh, did you really?
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, so my name is Mike Ingersoll. I played offensive line at UNC from 2006 to 2010.
A, the flat screen TVs, or B, the money?
The latter, B, the money, every day of the week.
Every day of the week.
The layer that within your question is, why do schools pay the money for televisions in the lockers and make the facilities look so nice? And that gets to something, a conversation I actually had in my sport law class, which was, you know, most athletic departments, most universities generally report losses on the year. The athletics department typically being the biggest source of money hemorrhage for any university, at least as they report it. But what a lot of people don't seem to pay attention to is that universities are nonprofit. Their job is to strike a zero at the end of the year on the balance sheet. Otherwise, they pay tax on whatever's left over. So that's like saying I made $100,000 this year and I spent all of it on every single thing I could think to spend it on related to my operation. And at the end of the year, I tell you, well, I didn't make any money this year. Well, that's not true. I made $100,000 and then I just spent it all. I didn't save any of it. That's what happens at universities. The second issue with that is that most schools have an endowment fund. So the cost to run an athletics department isn't what it's made out to be. There really isn't much of a cost for having players on campus when you have an endowment fund made up of private donations like we have here at UNC with the Rams Club. When you have an endowment fund paying for those scholarships, the university is actually making the scholarship money or is making the tuition money off of those students because somebody's paying their tuition. It's not the school. It's a private donor. So your question was a multi-layered one, and I hope I addressed it sufficiently.
Absolutely.
But yeah.
You rest your case,
you
right?
You rest your case.
I rest, Your Honor.
Hello?
Brandon Tate.
Yes, sir. What's going on, man? Brandon Tate, receiver for the Buffalo Bills. And I know Coach Shoop from my college days at North Carolina. He was my offensive coordinator.
A is the locker. B is the money.
If, you know, the money, I could probably send that, you know, help my mom out or maybe get me a used car or something, help me get around, you know, getting back and forth to home if I need to be.
I remember the last season that you were with us at North Carolina. The opening game of your last season there, you had 397 yards of total offense.
Yeah, man.
On just 11 touches, if I'm correct.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the game, we're in the locker room. Butch Davis, our head coach, turned and looked at me. And he goes, now, John, why don't you explain to me why this son of a gun only got 11 touches?
Oh, yeah, all right, folks. Take it easy, man.
Take it easy, Brandon.
You're listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century on Blue Ridge Public Radio.
Look behind you, Mark Emmer. Be careful.
Andy Schwartz, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm an antitrust economist. I live in California, and I study a lot of different elements of how firms interact in markets especially with a focus on how colleges and universities interact in terms of how they set prices for college athletes.
Why would this be a preferable strategy of expenditure over giving signing bonuses or fair wages to players?
Clearly not an efficient way for teams that want to excel athletically to recruit talent. If we were in a world where there wasn't an agreement among all the NCAA schools that they could spend as much money as they want on facilities, but they can't spend more than a certain amount per player on direct compensation. If we were in a different world where that direct compensation was allowed, we would see Clemson and Texas competing in an efficient way, treating athletes like adults, offering them compensation in exchange for their services, and not instead basically having to make them super cool rumpus rooms because they're being, you know, infantilized in some sense. And we can't trust you with money, but we're going to give you all sorts of nifty toys. The question of whether it's an arms race or not is actually probably a more complex one. Arms races, sort of by definition, need to be winner-take-all, and they need to be, in some sense, if you don't win, worthless. So you can imagine in a nuclear arms race what it really means to come in second, sufficiently second, that you lose. In recruiting, there is room in the world for more than one team to win financially, even if there's only room for one team to win the national championship each year. And so it's quite possible that both Clemson and Texas are smart, and the fact that Clemson is competing hard doesn't mean that Texas shouldn't or vice versa. So when people use that term, I know that colloquially just means a lot of spending, but a lot of spending that results in higher revenue or in better outcomes isn't necessarily bad. Generally speaking, anytime I hear people within an industry all on one side of the transaction saying, gosh, we're spending too much money, this is wasteful, I think, sounds a lot like every other price-fixing cartel has ever said. I think if you were to ask anybody, would you rather have $5,000 in cash or $10,000 in locker, most people would say, I would take the $5,000 in cash. So you can see how the prohibition of direct compensation leads to wasteful spending.
How can what players really want create an economic incentive for a different approach to recruiting?
I need to define a couple terms just so everyone knows what I'm talking about. When I say cartel, as an economist, I'm not talking about like a South American drug cartel. A cartel, economically, is simply a group of firms or schools, in this case, that get together and fix prices. This is a very technical term, but it's important. The second term is exploitation. And when I say exploitation, I don't mean enslaving somebody. I don't mean treating somebody necessarily even poorly. I simply mean when a cartel gets together and alters a market outcome so that a certain person gets substantially less than they would in the market. So you can imagine me, a highly paid economist, being exploited if suddenly all the lawyers that I work for got together and agreed to cut my pay in half. I'd still get paid a lot, but I would get paid less than I should. So with that said, of course, generally speaking, people would prefer cash over a locker room because unless they were going to use that cash to buy that locker, there's almost certainly a better use of the money that would please them more. Each of us is unique in many ways, although, you know, we share things in common as humans, and the sort of things that we would put on our list of ways to spend thousands of dollars, a fancy place to store our gear while we exercise is probably really low on it. And so you're giving people something that has cost, but the value that they personally receive from that is often less than if you had just given them the cash and allowed them to make their own choice, because we value choice a lot. And when we use choice, we can all usually pick the thing that gives us the most pleasure, not just accept like, well, this is better than nothing but. The agreement among the NCAA that says you can spend inefficiently, you can pay the coach and hope that the shiny patina of the coach brings in players. You can pay for a construction project and hope that the profits that the construction firm makes somehow translates into higher interest by athletes, but you can't pay them the optimal way, and you create this gap between what they would get value-wise and what they do get. That exploitation is super inefficient, but it's a natural fallout of a system where you have payers for the services basically agree to do it inefficiently, if that makes sense.
What are the economic costs to the larger society when players from economically challenged backgrounds don't have the opportunity to improve their own situation when they play college sports.
This is, I think, one of the most important things to recognize is that a large chunk of people playing FBS-level football or high-level Division I basketball come from families that are, as a family, living below the income, the poverty level, excuse me. Something between a third and a half of all FBS football athletes receive Pell Grants, and to get that means your family income has to be very, very low, and you're effectively, these athletes are in what could be their four best sports earning years. And you can imagine a world where instead of receiving most of their compensation in kind, an Xbox in the weight room or whatever, so they can take a little break from their lifting and work on their thumb skills. And instead, if they were to receive cash, how that could change the community. And so as a whole, we saw in the last 2 years, the NCAA, in part spurred on by the courts, has loosened the definition of what the maximum compensation is, so that now, in addition to room board, tuition, fees, and books, athletes can also receive a cash payment, and it varies from $2,000 to $5,000 depending on the school. Some of those that money is going back home to help younger siblings get educated, to help parents pay electricity bills, things like that. So it's almost like the way maybe the Mexican economy looks at workers who come to the United States and send back remittances back home, where it's not just the individual who is being entrepreneurial and gaining human capital by working at a job and gaining income. It's a whole community. And you could easily see the same thing happening in a world where a large swath of Pell recipients suddenly went from having effectively an 18 to 20-year-old that was neutral to the family income to being a major source of income, and how that could potentially result in all sorts of family uplift and community uplift. The other thing is just that because we are creating incentives for the money to be spent inefficiently, in essence, we're wasting money. If you were to poll all 50 of the athletes that you asked about the locker room, I would ask them, okay, how much would I have to pay you for you to give up that locker and go back to a junky metal locker like from high school? And I suspect some people would say $1,000, some people might say $9,000, but you'd get numbers that are less than $10,500. And if you think about that, all of that extra money is basically wasted. They would have come to the school for $3,000 instead of $10,000. And that $7,000 itself could be used as a society, could be used as an educational institution to fund academic scholarship. So it's not just that we're rerouting the money from poor people to the middle-class administrators who benefit from the system. We're also just burning some of it. It's like, you know, we're throwing money in a pit. Good luck with the show. I hope it becomes nationally syndicated within weeks.
Thank you, Andy. Say hello to Oakland for us.
Thanks, man.
Ready.
Well, I'm Iago Colas, and I'm a professor currently at the University of Michigan. I teach courses in the area of sports cultures.
So let's dig in here. First of all, how did Michigan engage in this so-called arms race?
The first thing that comes to my mind is a proper name, Jim Harbaugh, and the $9 million a year he's paid in a salary.
Do you think giving players money that is some form of payment or compensation that would actually create a more sustainable life for them would create more or less resentment among academicians than the posh athletic facilities and the high-paid coach?
If it came down to paying athletes, I believe there would be more resistance on the part of Michigan faculty, mainly because it would be a more candid sort of manifestation of the reality of college sports as Michigan participates in it today. It's easy to, maybe not easy, but it's possible in a way to kind of blinker athletics spending and facility spending at Michigan, partly because the athletics campus is segregated from the rest of the campus physically. So unless you are involved with athletes, you don't necessarily have to think about that a whole lot. Putting money in the pockets of the athletes who are earning the revenues within that sector of the entertainment industry, I think, would terrify Michigan faculty. I'm not sure they wouldn't come around eventually. You know, they, by and large, academics tend to, I think, try to be rational about things. And but this is an issue that they don't have a lot of information about yet. And so I think that they would initially be swayed by some of the myths around college athletics, that, you know, amateurism has a kind of value in and of itself that needs to be preserved, et cetera. And you know, all the myths you all are familiar with and have talked about frequently. So I think that it would be a hard pill to swallow initially. And there would be resistance, but I also think it could be worn down over time.
Thanks, Iago.
So, I don't know about you, but as I listen to all this and sift through and I wonder, investigate, and notice this whole phenomenon of the arms race, it strikes me that the arms race is an emblem of what's wrong in college sports, but just for a very different reason than people think it's an emblem of what's wrong. And one of the things that's, you know, kind of stands out for me is a quote that Coach Dabo Swinney said when Dabo Land was being built. And it is this. He said, quote, "I am pumped. It's going to be the epitome of Clemson. Fun, special, unique. It's going to be the best in the country without a doubt. And everything in this building is what's best for our players." And that really just, again, strikes at the core of what I feel like we've been learning these last several years is who says what's best for the players? And why are players' voices never, you know, kind of in the mix of how these decisions are made? You know, there was not even a blink of any player that said, "Oh yeah, I'd like that."
Well, I was reminded of a time when I was at the University of North Carolina, and we had as posh of a players' lounge as anywhere in the country, and I noticed none of our players used the lounge. If anything, players might take a nap in there between classes, but we had this beautiful, posh lounge with all these games, chairs, pool tables, everything, and it was rarely used. So I investigated it, and I asked a player, "Why aren't any of the players using this beautiful space that we've created?" The response, "Coach, in the football offices here, no girls are allowed. If we go across the street to the student union, that's where all the girls are, and you'll find most of the football team there." So I just wonder then when some of these universities are going to take the money that they're spending on all these things. I mean, I really wonder how much putt-putt golf the Clemson University football team is going to play.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder how much TV a University of Texas football player is going to watch in his locker with another 100 TVs blaring right next to him. And I wonder when a university is going to take that money and instead give it to the player so the player can use it for expenses in that player's life. What a wonderful recruiting tool that would be.
Yeah.
Every player that we've talked to would rather have that money to send home to mom and dad so they could travel to all the away games than they would have a 43-inch flat-screen TV. So
right. That's
what I've noticed. And now I wonder who's going to be the first team to make that recruiting ploy.
Yeah, I want to put that challenge out there. I wonder, you know, who's going to be the first conference? Who's going to be the first university or collection of universities? Is it going to be in Alabama who's like, "We don't give a crap what you think. We're going to do this because this is what players want and we want the best players"? Or is it going to be a group of schools that are kind of second tier trying to make it into the top and they finally think, you know what, this is our little secret weapon. And we are self-sufficient enough. We don't need you, NCAA. We're gonna be autonomous. And we're going to give this money to players instead of pay for facilities. I wonder who's going to be the first one to figure it out. And I think there is the wisdom of, well, players need to organize, players need to, you know, get together and say what they want. Sure, that needs to happen too. But somewhere out there, surely, there is a wise and savvy institution or conference that says, you know what, we're going to get the jump on this, and we're going to be the first out the gate to do something that could really be a sea change in revenue sports in colleges. What changed my mind on this issue is really the same thing that has shifted my thinking as someone who was raised in an academic family and would have always, you know, kind of defaulted to the person who's like, oh, athletics has become too important. I was a Division III athlete. But the thing that has shifted my mind is just the stark reality of how little those who are impacted the most are consulted and what would actually work. Universities are wasting money. Players would come to the school for less than they're paying for the putt-putt golf course.
It's almost comical to think the amount of money that's spent on some of these facilities, and then see academicians or
academicians.
Is that the word? Or university presidents. Did I say that word right?
I don't know. Now that you've said it, I can't think of if it's right or
see
wrong.
See a lot of college professors, see a lot of university presidents up in arms about the possibility of paying players, but you're okay with giving them a locker worth $10,500.
For a nap room.
Frankly, that's kind of clownish behavior.
Yeah.
It's almost comical. I wonder when an administration's going to get sick and tired of just propping up this
craziness.
This craziness and just say, let's get down to brass tacks and give them what they need.
And give them what they deserve.
Amen to that.
You've been listening to Going Deep, Sports in the 21st Century, from the studios of Blue Ridge Public Radio, NPR for Western North Carolina. Tell us what you think of the show by emailing us at goingdeep@bpr.org. Make sure to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter @ShoopsGoingDeep.